order. The question is the motion in the name of the Leader of the Opposition on the government's economic, employment and industrial policies. I call upon the Prime Minister to move her amendment. Point of order.
Before the right honourable lady starts, can we be assured that the public school punks opposite will be quiet?
Order. 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 Well, I hope the whole house will be quiet.
No, no, no.
Mr. Speaker, sir, I beg to move the amendment which stands on the order paper in the name of my right honourable friends and myself. This debate, Mr. Speaker, arises upon an opposition motion which calls into question the economic policy of the government. It is, of course, wholly appropriate that we should debate these issues just before the long recess. After 13 months of the present Parliament, we are more than happy to take stock of the performance of both government and opposition. The last 40 minutes, Mr. Speaker, we have listened to the rhetoric of the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Leader of the Opposition. It was difficult, if I might say so, to find a thread running through his speech. I might say so, it was a speech which matched the motion, but not the occasion. As I listened, I concluded not for the first time, that the Right Honourable Gentleman's compatriot, the late Nye Bevan, was wrong. The religion of socialism is not the language of priorities, it is the priority of language. I listened to the words and the statistics of the Right Honourable Gentleman. One could not possibly discern any policy there. He wanted widespread expansion. He wanted a high deficit. Nevertheless, he wanted low interest rates, and he failed to observe that the United States has had a very strict monetary policy and a very much smaller proportion of its national income devoted to public expenditure than this. He criticised the level of national insurance contributions, but I don't hear him moving motions to reduce the amount of pensions. He had something to say about North Sea oil, but he failed to see that if we are successful as we are in producing North Sea oil, the people who earn money from that industry will either buy more manufactured goods from abroad, leading to higher imports, or we shall, from their efforts, be able to have exports of capital to repay the assets in future years. But he's against both higher imports and the exports of capital. His words, in fact, were emotive, excessive and evasive. In debating these issues of economic policy, the interest of the House and the country lies not in hyperbole, but in realism. Perhaps he would do well to remember the words of the noble Lord, Lord Barnet, which he wrote in a book, Inside the Treasury, when he said this: the 1974-79 Labour government had a difficult economic and financial task, rendered impossible by pledges foolishly made without any serious thought as to where the money would come from. You name it, he said, we were pledged to increase it. Judging by the Right Honourable Gentleman's speech, the opposition have learned nothing. As I expected, Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable
Order
devoted much of his speech to unemployment. And I shall have more to say about unemployment later in my own speech. But at the outset, I want to make one point. Unemployment won't be cured by the quick fix, by injections of public spending, each becoming less potent than the last. The result will only be record inflation. On this side of the House, we won't peddle the easy solutions which do so much damage in the long run. We care enough about unemployment to do the difficult things which alone will achieve a lasting improvement in our capacity to create new jobs. Nevertheless, the Right Honourable Gentleman still claims to be able to put Britain back to work by extra spending and extra borrowing. What credibility can he possibly have in criticising the present level of interest rates when his policies could only result in interest rates much higher still? Those policies would end as they did before, with the nation's finances in disarray. Cap in hand to the IMF. The Right Honourable Gentleman is aware of the consequences of what happened last time. He mentioned some of them. May I just mention two, if he spoke about one? First, Britain's overseas debt was doubled during the lifetime of the last Labour government. Second, spending on the National Health Service was cut in real terms for the first time in 25 years. And yet he has the nerve to attack a government which was paid back half those debts and which has spent more in real terms on the National Health Service every year since we have been in power. At best, the Right Honourable Gentleman's economic thesis is inadequate. At worst, it would destroy the jobs we have and drive away those we seek to gain. That spending programme was a programme his party put to the electorate, who saw to it at the last election that the Labour Party recorded the lowest share of the popular vote in its history. By contrast, this government has accepted the challenge of long-term economic reform. And I will now divide what I have to say into three parts. First, the framework for the government's economic policy, then what I have to say on unemployment, and then what I have to say on the coal strike. The central objective of our economic policy has been to create in Britain the framework of a market economy, the kind of responsive economy in which industry and commerce can flourish, not only to produce goods and provide jobs, but also to generate the wealth upon which our public services depend. Our strategy demands sound money and lower inflation, both of which we have achieved. It welcomes technological change, and it ensures the freedom which comes from the wider ownership of property. The requirement for a successful market economy is a defeat of inflation. It was Lenin's dictum that if you wish to destroy a nation, first debauch its currency. And he was speaking as a dedicated revolutionary and not as a prophetic monetarist. Our first aim, therefore, has been to defend our nation by defending the worth of its currency and to break for good the
dangerous
inflation. Thanks to the prudent financial policies pursued by my right honourable friends, the Chancellor of the Exchequer and his predecessor, the prize of lower inflation has been won and we shall not put it in jeopardy now. Stable prices remain our eventual goal. And our ability, stable prices, something the Right Honourable Gentleman never achieved and never could. Our ability to protect ourselves against the tide of overseas interest rates depends on sticking to these policies. Countries like Germany and Switzerland have long succeeded in keeping their interest rates well below American rates, but only because they first earned an international reputation for sound money and low inflation. The Right Honourable Gentleman chided us on interest rates. May I remind him that over the time of the last... May I remind him that over the lifetime of the last Labour government, United Kingdom interest rates were on average 4% higher than United States rates. That has changed. A few weeks ago, our short-term interest rates were nearly 3% lower than comparable United States rates. Damaging industrial strikes have temporarily robbed us of this advantage. We shall seek to regain it. But if we follow the prescription of the Right Honourable Gentleman for more public spending, not only would interest rates rise more sharply, but we should lose as well the prospect of reducing direct taxation and leaving people more of their own earnings to spend and save as they choose. Our task in reducing income tax is not an easy one. A little longer, as my right honourable friend the Chancellor said in his budget speech. If you listen, you might hear something to your advantage. Indeed, as public
order,
practically in the post-war period, so the taxation net has inevitably spread much more widely. In 1936, only 3.5 million people paid income tax. And a married man did not begin to pay until he earned 1.5 times average wages. Now nearly 24 million people pay income tax, starting at less than half average wages. And if we followed the Right Honourable Gentleman's prescriptions, a lot more would be paying a lot more higher income tax. We have made a start in reducing personal tax. Since 1979, the income tax threshold has risen by 16% in real terms. It fell under Labour. Yet a modern market economy is not just a matter of taxes and incentives. It is about...
Order!
Oh, they daren't listen, Mr. Speaker. They can only shout because they have no arguments. Mr. Speaker, I shall plough steadily on. Yet a modern market economy is not just a matter of taxes and incentives. It is about competition too. Competition that puts the customer first and keeps the producer on his toes, because what you produce you need to sell, and you will sell only if other people are prepared to buy. And no amount of controls or restrictive practices or planning or monopoly can win Britain export orders. Only being competitive can do that. And this is the only policy that makes sense for a country which derives 30% of its national income from the world's marketplace. Mr. Speaker, it's a matter of record that those who succeed best in the markets of today are those who are willing to adapt to change, producing new goods and services as new tastes develop. In the past, mechanisation in the end created more jobs than it destroyed. And the same will surely be true of today's innovations, the new electronics, the computer, the cable and the satellite. But for those whose jobs are lost, the process of change can be painful, and we must stand ready to mitigate the hardship for them and their communities by generous redundancy payments, by retraining, and by help to create new business. But to cling to old industries, old processes, and old working practices leads not to the security which people seek, but to the very decline which they fear. Yet, Mr. Speaker,
could she be more precise in saying how her government is going to create new businesses for my constituents at British Leyland in Bathgate with what they face? How is it going to be done?
The Right Honourable Gentleman is aware the government can do certain things to help. It can keep inflation down. It can give incentives in personal taxation. I shall be coming on to that in a moment. It can help with things like enterprise allowance, loan guarantees, and things to help the creation of small business. It can reduce bureaucracy. All of that this government is doing. In the end, it will be for the people to respond to that by going out and creating and being prepared to build up businesses for themselves. The Right Honourable Gentleman extolled the virtues of the United States. They have an enterprise culture under which people are prepared to do that in response to the incentives that they are given. May I now come on as part of the market economy to the subject of ownership? Because, Mr. Speaker, if we disagree between the sides, each side of this House about the importance of inflation, the reduction of income tax and the management of change, it is still the role of private property in society which divides the House most sharply. Indeed, the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Leader of the Opposition, has said, "We cannot remove the evils of capitalism," he said, "without taking its source of power, ownership." Ownership is indeed a source of power, which is precisely why more of it should be with the citizen and less with the state. Look around the world and we see that those countries which deny private property rights are those which also deny the other human rights. We seek to redress the balance between the citizen and the state by restoring to private ownership industries which have lain under the pall of nationalisation. In the past year alone, Enterprise Oil, Scott Lithgow,
Order,
Witch Farm, Inmos and Jaguar have passed into the true ownership of the citizens, and many of their employees have been the first to acquire a stake in them. We are well on course for the denationalisation of British Telecom and British Airways in the coming year. Most fundamental of all, 750,000 of families are buying their own council houses, a policy which Labour opposed the whole way. And those who are buying their own council houses are freeing themselves from the control of town halls. Indeed, owner occupation is at an all-time record. Mr. Speaker, socialists oppose the widening of property ownership because it brings to every citizen a new independence and because it breaks down the old class divisions on which they thrive. We seek a country where every earner can be an owner, a country which will be utterly repugnant to socialism. So that capital and labour have a shared interest and class divisions are a thing of the past. Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Gentleman spewed out statistics. I will now give just a few of our very tangible achievements. Because sound money, lower income tax, competition and ownership, these are long-term policies, but they have already brought real advances. Inflation this year and last is the lowest for 16 years. Output is higher than ever before. It appears to be a laughing matter for honourable gentlemen. I thought they said good news for Britain was good news for the Labour Party. Yet when one says output is higher than ever before, they don't seem to like that it's been achieved by a Conservative government. Productivity at record levels, real personal disposable income to all our citizens higher than at any time under Labour. Profits up 40% over the last 2 years. Investment up 10% on a year earlier. We are providing a framework for an enterprising economy whose success can alone provide for the public services we need. Indeed, Mr. Speaker. Well, I will in a moment, may I just finish this section. Indeed, on health, education and social security, our record stands comparison with that of any previous government, and indeed it is better than the previous one. So I say to the House, therefore, that far from the caricature of the economy drawn in the opposition's motion and the caricature of the Right Honourable Gentleman's speech, the deep-seated problems in our economy are at last being tackled and real advances have been made. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
How does the Prime Minister respond to the protests of our Honourable friend, the Member for Cambridge South East, who accuses her of insensitivity to people in need and inflexibility and is supported by Conservatives in Portsmouth after the by-election who equally accused her of inflexibility? Are they all wrong, or could they possibly be right?
But there are not half as many of them as right who are the two who voted this government into power with its biggest majority in history and after that won the European elections. They are very much more likely to be right in their judgments. But I'm grateful to the Honourable Member for the point of time at his intervention, but I was just about to come to the point of my speech when I'm dealing with unemployment. Because with unemployment as high as it is and still rising, the challenge of creating jobs is the main challenge of our times. The success of the long-term policies, of which I've already spoken, is vital if we are to tackle the fundamental causes of unemployment rather than the symptoms. But there are other steps. This year's budget saw the abolition of the National Insurance Surcharge. Something we promised to complete this Parliament, but which we achieved in the first session. And the budget also saw the reconstruction of corporation tax. Now, taken together, Mr. Speaker, those two measures will greatly reduce the bias in favour of machinery and against the employment of people, a bias introduced by the last Labour government. To stimulate the growth of new business in Britain, the budget has also improved share option schemes and reduced direct taxation. We cannot yet compete with the United States in the tax incentives offered to industrial pathfinders, but we are getting closer. May I carry on? I'll give away in a moment. This government applauds those who can earn high incomes by building new enterprise and creating jobs for others. We want more of them and more of them here. They are assets to our country, not for us, the Right Honourable Gentleman's ill-disguised xenophobia to foreign investment and enterprise.
On the question of jobs, is it not a fact that every month since this government came into power, we have lost jobs? Can she tell us when we will balance out that jobs lost? The jobs lost in any month will equal the jobs gained. That position has not yet arrived after 5 years of her government. When will it come?
But Mr. Speaker, unemployment has fluctuated, although I accept the Honourable Gentleman.
Order!
The Honourable Gentleman's underlying assumption. It has, of course, risen and is continuing to rise. I said that a moment ago. It has not risen every single month. It has, of course, it is a very great burden and it is a very great tragedy, as I indicated. But if the Honourable Gentleman's government
order
answers to unemployment, why then did they let it rise to 1.5 million? If they'd known the answers, they too would, in fact, have been able substantially to reduce it 1.5 million. I'm sure if the Right Honourable Members knew the answer, they would not have let unemployment rise like that. They did not know it. And there are many, many people in Europe who have just as great problems with it as we have. And I was going on to try to analyse some of the causes. Because over a long period of years, the United States economy, and indeed the Japanese as well, not just recently, but over the last 15 years, have been much more successful than those in Europe in creating new jobs. And at the recent London summit, we spent some time considering the reasons. And the answers appear to lie, first, in the greater flexibility of their labour markets, where wages and working practices adapt much more quickly to economic conditions. Second, in their greater readiness to seize the opportunity of new technologies. Third, in their greater willingness to move from older manufacturing industries into services. And fourth, in the very much larger part played by small businesses in their economy. And this government, therefore, has set out to improve the education and training of our young people to equip them for the changing world they will face. The youth training scheme, the best of its kind in Europe, provided 350,000 places last year. The enterprise allowance scheme is helping 1,000 a week of the unemployed to set up their own businesses. The latest figures on unemployment have been deeply disappointing, but other indicators suggest a strengthening in the labour market. Vacancies are up for the fourth month running. The number of people in work has risen by 260,000 over the past year, with 330,000 extra jobs in service industries. Now, again, I understood the Right Honourable Gentleman to say that they welcome good news. They seem singularly reluctant to share it. This increase in the number of jobs is welcome, at any rate to this side of the House. But it comes at a time when the numbers in the working population are rising still faster. In the past 6 years, those leaving school have outnumbered those retiring from work by over a million, and this trend will continue for the rest of the decade. So our task... I hope the Honourable Member will not accuse any government of being responsible for the demographic figures, because it would be totally wrong if he does. So our task of creating sufficient jobs is made even harder by these demographic factors. But the employment figures belie the opposition charges of a stagnant economy. Every month, 340,000 people leave the unemployment register. About 28,000 new service sector jobs are created, and about 10,000 new businesses start up. Every quarter, it is estimated that self-employment increases by 17,000. Every year, some 6 million people change jobs. Now, the proportion of our people in work in this country is about the same as in Germany, but higher than that in France, Belgium, Italy, and the Netherlands. The problems of unemployment are severe, but they are not helped by the attempt of the opposition to pretend that there is an easy answer, which happens to have eluded most of the countries of Western Europe and also eluded them in government. The claim of the party opposite to represent the interests of the unemployed is totally hollow. They are the party which opposes efforts to restructure industry to meet changing demands. They are the party which in opposition supports every wage claim, even where its effect is to price people out of work. They are the party which supports every strike, no matter what its pretext, no matter how damaging. But above all, Mr. Speaker, it is the Labour Party's support for the striking miners against the working miners which totally destroys all credibility for their claim to represent the true interests of working people in this country. It's a tragedy that this coal strike has occurred at a time when the coal industry had the brightest prospects for many years. The government has shown its commitment to the industry by a massive investment programme far in excess of plan for coal. New export orders were being won. Applications for conversion from oil to coal were running at record levels under this government. Now, since the strike, 8 coal faces have already been lost. I understand that the closure of faces as a result of this strike is equivalent to the capacity of about 4 pits. And the National Coal Board have said that faces at 25 more pits are at risk. The National Coal Board are having to buy coal from abroad, to meet a major export order for America, which could guarantee 1,000 jobs in Durham for 10 years. There are now more withdrawals than applications for coal conversion grants, and the investment program is being held up. All of these things are bad both for the future of the coal industry and for the miners who are on strike and for their families. Not only have they lost about £3,000 per family on average, but also their jobs are being put at risk by the very leaders who claim to defend them. Perhaps that's why the leadership of the National Union of Mine Workers, having failed on three previous occasions to gain the requisite majority by a ballot, resorted to a series of devices to call this strike without a national ballot. The leader of the opposition remained silent on the question of a ballot until the NUM changed its rules to reduce the required majority. Then he told the House that a national ballot of the National Union of Mine Workers is a clearer and closer prospect. That was on the 12th of April, the last time we heard from him on the subject of a ballot.
Yeah. Where is he now?
But on the 14th of July, he appeared at an NUM rally and said, "There is no alternative but to fight. All other roads are shut off." What happened to the ballot? What happened to the ballot? He knows that this strike, started by manipulation of union rules, has been maintained by violence and intimidation. Methods which are repugnant to the vast majority of miners. We've seen up to 10,000 so-called pickets massed to prevent other workers from going to work by fear or by violence. And such picketing is not just in clear contravention of the TUC guidelines. It breaches the instruction given in 1974 by the National Union of Mine Workers itself that the number of pickets should not exceed 6 in any local situation. And I hope, therefore, that today the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Sparkbrook, when he winds up, will end Labour equivocation with a clear condemnation of mass picketing. Condemnation of mass picketing. One moment. That would at least be one ambiguity he could clear up. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
I'm obliged to the Right Honourable Lady. But since the Right Honourable Lady must be aware that the decision of the National Union of Mine Workers to hold the Special Delegate Conference on Friday, 9th of August, was a lifeline for her in the sense that she could assist to get negotiations taking place before that the conference met. Are we to take it that while she's speaking today on behalf of the government, that the policy she's telling this House and the country is that she will starve the miners' wives and families into submission? Will the Right Honourable Lady not agree that that policy is a political and social disaster for this country?
Speaker, there are good jobs for those striking miners, and they know it. If anyone is stabbing them in the back, it is not this government. I notice the Honourable Gentleman, neither of them took advantage of the interjection to condemn mass picketing or to condemn the union for not having a national ballot. Violence and intimidation have failed in their objectives to close down the steel industry, failed to prevent the movement of coal, and failed to coerce working miners into joining the strike. For that we must thank not only the courage of those who have stayed at work and their families, but also the police who've commanded widespread support and gratitude.
Order!
Mr. Speaker, the millions of the members of the working population who are subsidising the mining industry and miners' jobs to the tune of £130 a week are entitled to ask what this dispute is about. This dispute is not about pay, because the current offer will keep miners 25% above the industrial average compared with 18% of under Labour. It is not about compulsory redundancies. There have been none. And there have already been well over 20,000 inquiries about voluntary redundancy, more than the number of redundancies the National Coal Board are seeking. It is not about voluntary redundancy terms, because those are the most generous ever. £33,000 for a 49-year-old miner compared with £1,500 under Labour. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
Would the Prime Minister assist the House in letting us know, bearing in mind that all the other pit closures in the past had been done in accordance with the Colliery View project, why was the decision taken, and who took the decision, to close Corton Wood without a negotiation in accordance with the Colliery View project?
Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is well aware of the pit closure procedure and the precise ways in which it has to go through. I am coming on. I am grateful to him for interrupting where he did, because I am just coming on to the subject of pit closures. I have just indicated what the dispute is not about. It's not about pay, it's not about compulsory redundancies, it's not about voluntary redundancy terms. But after 7 days and 35 hours of talks between the National Coal Board and the National Union of Mine Workers, the only point at issue was the National Union of Mine Workers' demand that pits should remain open even when they are not beneficial to the industry. Now, this is a new and a totally unreasonable demand. The tripartite report of the last Labour government, which endorsed the National Coal Board plan for coal in 1974, said, and I quote, "Inevitably, some pits will have to close as their useful economic reserves of coal are depleted." That report was signed, amongst others, by the then Secretary of State for Energy, Mr. Eric Varley, and by the Honourable Member for Midlothian. The last Labour government not only accepted the principle that uneconomic capacity must be closed, they embodied it in legislation. In the Coal Industry Act of 1977, passed when the Honourable Gentleman, the present Member for Chesterfield, was Secretary of State for Energy, Section 6 provides that the Secretary of State may make to the National Coal Board such grants as, in his opinion, and I quote, "will further assist in the redeployment of the manpower resources of the board and the elimination of uneconomic colliery capacity." Gentleman, the Member for Cheshire, I must give way to him, but of course I will, if he wishes, give way to the other Right Honourable Gentleman first.
Honourable Lady now answer the question. As she referred to the plan for coal, would the Right Honourable Lady now answer the question that she failed to put when it was put by my Honourable friend before? Does she think the plan for coal was properly carried out in the Corton Wood case?
That's the important.
Mr. Speaker, the Corton Wood will go through the normal procedures, and that has been said. Gentleman is trying to do is to distract attention from the fact that the closure of uneconomic pits was not only a Labour policy, they had it in legislation. They first put it in legislation in 1965 and they re-embodied it in legislation in the time of the Right Honourable Gentleman. Having mentioned him, I give way to the Right Honourable Gentleman.
I'm grateful for the Prime Minister for delivering herself completely into our hands, because, of course, because every time there was a discussion about the future of a pit, the National Union of Mine Workers was consulted. And she will know very well that as Secretary of State, I offered the NUM a veto on all pit closures. And therefore, the reason why the Courton Wood case precipitated, as was intended, a national coal strike was that the Prime Minister wanted to precipitate it by breaking the essential element in the plan for coal, which was agreement with the NUM on the future of the union.
Oh, sir, Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Gentleman absolutely agrees with the closure of...
Order! Order! It's no good, Honourable Gentleman, saying, shouting, answer the Prime Minister. She's seeking to do so.
But the Right Honourable Gentleman has not argued for one moment that he's against the closure of uneconomic pits. He put it in legislation. What he has argued... I will, if the Right Honourable Members will actually be quiet for a moment. What he has argued... is it all right to close uneconomic pits, provided the correct procedure is followed? Of course he has. Of course he has. That's precisely the essence of his argument. So he agrees with the closure of uneconomic pits, and he's trying to use Courton Wood as a way of saying the procedure is not being followed. The National Coal Board has made it clear that the procedure at Courton Wood will be followed. So if honourable members and right honourable members opposite agree they enshrine the policy of the closure of uneconomic pits in legislation, and that all that is between us is procedure, then the strike should soon end.
Order! I don't think the Prime Minister was giving way.
Mr. Speaker, I have some more to say about the Right Honourable. Mr. Speaker, I have some more to say about the Right Honourable Gentleman. Some more to say about the Right Honourable Gentleman, at the end of which I will gladly give way to him again. I have some more to say about him. I'm sure he'll wish to intervene when I've said it, and I will gladly give way to him. And of course, uneconomic capacity was closed under the last Labour government. Indeed, during the stewardship of the Right Honourable Gentleman, the member for Chesterfield, 22 pits were closed, some of them uneconomic, and 17,000 men became redundant on terms that were not a patch of those on those available now. And as the Right Honourable Gentleman, the present member for Chesterfield, said in the House on the 4th of December 1978, I quote, "I have never found the NUM in any way unreasonable where closures are necessary because of exhaustion or because pits are out of line in economic terms." I give way.
The Prime Minister, with every comment, makes our case. Absolutely. And let the country understand that the reason why the National Union of Mine Workers gave their support to the plan for coal was that the whole future of the industry, including closures, was done by agreement with them. And that the reason why there is a coal strike is that the government deliberately and had prepared it years in advance, prepared to break the agreement with the mine workers that the industry would be developed in agreement with them. And if the Prime Minister tonight told Mr. McGregor that there was to be a settlement on the basis that all closures would be agreed with the NUM, the strike would end tonight.
Not prepared to hand over the management of the National Coal Board in my time any more than he did in his. And if he looks at that speech, he'll find that he said if the NUM came to us, he could in fact pass on what they said to the National Coal Board. The National Coal Board must be free to manage, but he makes the point. He is quibbling about the procedure of these pits. He is admitting that it was his policy to close uneconomic pits. He is admitting that he repeated it in legislation, and he cannot plead that he didn't know what he was doing when he confirmed it in legislation.
Order,
but now, Mr. Speaker,
Order. The Prime Minister doesn't give way. The Honourable Gentleman, right, Honourable Gentleman. Order. Yep, I think the right Honourable Lady is not giving way, is she?
Twice to the right Honourable Gentleman. When I have answered him, I assume he will have a chance to catch your eye again, Mr. Speaker. And may I also say that as I have still yet more to say about the right Honourable Gentleman, he will have another chance to intervene. To follow the leadership of the National Union of Mine Workers, the Labour Party seems to have repudiated the policy of the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Chester. Oh, but it has, because it is for the closure of uneconomic pits. For the closure. The Opposition's new view now seems to comprise two elements. First, pits must never be closed, regardless of cost, unless they're geologically exhausted. Secondly, there should be more investment in old pits, presumably at the expense of new pits. Those are totally new from the policy which they followed in practice. The taxpayer is already spending $1.3 billion a year on the coal industry. That, Mr. Speaker, is more than the total of the salaries of doctors and dentists in National Health Service hospitals. It's the equivalent of 28 pence on petrol. It's equivalent to an increase of more than £2 a week in the retirement pension. It is double the total amount spent on all four scientific research councils. Labour's new policy would mean that the subsidy would increase without limit. Mr. Speaker, it is the government's policy to phase out subsidies in the nationalised industries. What was that? In line with this, it is the government's policy to phase out subsidies to the nationalised industries. In line with this, the government hoped that the coal industry will be able to operate without the need for assistance apart from social grants. That, Mr. Speaker, what I have just said was something which I hoped I could agree with the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Chesterfield, because those are his words and not mine.
I'm grateful to the Prime Minister again for clarifying the difference between the two sides of the House. The difference that has emerged in her latest comment is that she believes what's valuable is the coal and we believe what's valuable are the miners. And that is the difference between our approach to the future of the industry and her own.
Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Gentleman runs away from it again. He put the closure of uneconomic pits into legislation. He operated that policy, and he is now attempting to change it. Mr. Speaker, we can only improve our industrial performance if an efficient coal industry can provide the cheap energy that workers in other industries need to stay competitive, so that they can keep their jobs and win others. And I would have thought it'd be a matter of pride for the coal industry that it should make profits which could pay for schools and hospitals rather than losses which drain funds away from them. In the market economy, an efficient coal industry should help to finance the social services, not become one itself. And it's because we believe that the coal industry has a prosperous future based on efficient new capacity that we are not prepared to write the blank cheque on the taxpayer which the National Union of Mine Workers and the Labour Party demand. The offer which the National Coal Board has made to the miners is a fair and reasonable one. Indeed, as a former president of the TUC said at the weekend, it is the most generous that he could recall for any group of workers. In making that possible, the government has carried out its proper role. And I hope that before too long, this message will get through and that miners will return to build the prosperous future that awaits them and that peace will return to the coal fields. Mr. Speaker, one reason why the strike has not ended before now is the aid and comfort given to the leadership of the NUM by the Right Honourable Gentleman and his friend. A branch colliery president was recently quoted as saying of the Leader of the Opposition, and it was reported in the Sunday Telegraph, he has let himself be used as a puppet by the people who believe in extra-parliamentary tactics, and he has fallen for it hook, line and sinker. The Right Honourable Gentleman leads a party which claims to support democracy, but repudiates those miners who voted democratically to remain at work and have done so in accordance with their union procedure. He leads a party which condemns violence in general, but supports the mass picketing which inevitably ends in violence. He leads a party which has allied itself to the wreckers against the workers. The forces to which the Right Honourable Gentleman has lent his voice and support have no more love for parliamentary democracy than for the jobs and homes of those who oppose them. Sooner or later, when he has ceased to be of value to their purpose, they will turn on him just as surely as they have turned on the police, on the steelworkers, on the working miners, and on their families. To describe the policy of the Right Honourable Gentleman when faced with threats, whether from home or abroad, and that word is appeasement. Yeah. He will live to regret it. It is no policy for Britain. Yeah.